stopped at the Strand bookstore, and I saw that they had remaindered this book.
Crazy Cock, yeah.
Yeah, so I picked that one up today and started. I read the introduction and the foreword, and leafed through it. I haven't had it. I haven't read it all. I don't know that I will. But I really can see the difference. Now, I was, obviously, as you point out, in Devil at Large, I was one of those who also, when I read Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Cancer, Capricorn, you know, I would pick out the good parts. You know?
Right, we all did that.
Well, you see...
That's normal,
yeah,
I think.
You see, but I was a product of the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no sex education or anything like that, and any books that had anything to do with sex were prohibited. So you never found out anything. You know, I would ask my father about... I remember once we were driving cross-country in the Midwest, stopped at a gas station, and in the men's room there was this machine, and it said, for the prevention of disease only.
Not supposed to have any fun.
25 cents. So I said, hey, Dad, what is that? And my father said, I'll tell you later. Well, my father died this past January, and I was still waiting up until the end of his life. He is still yet to tell me what that machine was. So when you read Tropic of Cancer, you found out what people really did.
Right.
Because everything else, you just kind of had to imagine. Well, let's talk about those repressive days and Henry Miller's impact on us.
Well, you know, the history of it is that Tropic of Cancer was written in 31, 32. In Paris, was not published until 34 by Jack Kahan, Obelisk Press. Could never have been published in the United States, but it was smuggled into the United States in these kind of tattered editions. In 1962, the Supreme Court liberated Tropic of Cancer fully 30 years after its composition. It was published here by Barney Rossett, became an instant bestseller for all the wrong reasons. Henry was seen as the king of smut. And within, I would say, 6 years, it had transformed the face of American literature. 1968 came Couples by John Updike. 1969 came Portnoy's Complaint by Philip Roth. 1973, Fear of Flying, which I wrote. A whole series of books by women and men, which opened the bedroom door. And that was the direct result of the publication in America of Tropic of Cancer. By 1970... a feminist backlash had set in, so that Kate Millett published Sexual Politics. Kate Millett, by the way, is an admirer of Miller, but she pointed out that his attitude towards women was misogynistic. And in so doing, she started another Miller backlash, the feminist Miller backlash. So here was this writer who was banned in his own country for 40 years, finally is published in his own country, starts a tremendous revolution in the way people are allowed to write. And then he is proscribed again, but this time not by the Comstocks, but by the Andrea Dworkins of the world. So you have this crazy literary career, basically. In the midst of this, I meet Henry Miller in 1974 after I published Fear of Flying. And I, who had read Tropic of Cancer the way you had read it, you know, looking for the good parts, and Henry becomes my friend and my supporter and my really my mentor during a year that I'm going through transformation from being a young poet to a household word, a menace, a public menace, which is what my literary reputation was and in some places still is.
Can we go back a little bit? You said when you read Tropic of Cancer, and reading the so-called good parts, did this experience of reading Tropic of Cancer have any impact on you as you began to write Fear of Flying?
It was enormously liberating. I mean, the thing that Miller discovered in Tropic of Cancer was this exuberant first-person voice that followed the meanderings of the mind, that followed everything a person thought as he walked down the streets of Paris. He really got inside the head of a character. And there was something extremely freeing about that. Seeing where he started in Crazy Cock, which is a very turgid literary novel, almost not worth publishing, except as a textbook on what a writer shouldn't do before he discovers his own voice. But Tropic of Cancer is this book that gives you breath, Life, Freedom, tells you that you can write about what's going on inside your head, and you can write with freedom. And I had that feeling reading those parts of Tropic of Cancer. It gave me freedom. And I can tell you that, that's been an experience that every writer I've talked to who read Miller experienced. Even the ones who didn't particularly like him, they said, I opened the book and there was freedom, the freedom to be, to speak on the page as one speaks in life.
But when you wrote Fear of Flying and subsequent books with some explicit sexual passages, this does take a certain amount of courage, because don't you think of your, what would your mother say, your father?
Well, you tell yourself it will never be published. I mean, what I did was, when I was writing Fear of Flying, I said, this will never be published. It isn't a proper novel. It's a rant, but I have to write it. And I wrote it with a pounding heart, thinking, God, if anyone finds this, I'm in trouble. But also feeling I had to get it down on paper. So, I mean, the problems for a woman writer writing that kind of stuff were and are daunting. I mean, women who write about sex are always treated with complete disrespect. I mean, even this week, I picked up the New Yorker and saw a long essay on Anais Nin and Henry Miller. I think I've started a Miller revival with The Devil at Large. I hope so. But it really trashes Anais Nin, this piece in the New Yorker, for her sexual freedom. Now, you wouldn't think this was possible circa 1993. This is less a review of incest by Nin than it is an attack on Anais Nin for being a slut, a tramp, a whore. And this is really what happens to women who write about sex.
Well, I'm not. Well, I don't know. I've read so many excellent books. Maria Fluke's first novel has a lot of very explicit sexual passages, including incest between a brother and sister. Sue Miller, her, I can't remember what was the last book. I can't remember. Not The Good Mother, but the one that she wrote after that. Has a lot of very explicit sex. I can go on and on. I interview so many people, I can't, they kind of jumble mm-hmm. in my mind, but I think women have been completely liberated and can be as explicit as they want without feeling any particular feeling of guilt, don't you?
Mm-mm.
No?
Nope. That hasn't been my experience. If the woman does the proper thing and makes the heroine be punished for her sexuality, as in The Good Mother, the heroine loses her child, or in Edna O'Brien's August is a Wicked Month, the heroine loses her son is killed, or as in Mary McCarthy's A Charmed Life, the heroine in the last paragraph goes into an ongoing truck. Sexual heroines are always caused to die for their sins, or they lose a child, or they lose their life, or they lose... I mean, I think that the archetype is really strong still. That doesn't mean that women aren't allowed to write about sex. They do write about sex. But a sexual heroine must be punished. Also in movies. That's the archetype that our society believes in. The sexual heroine must be punished. And I see it. I see it everywhere. Now, you might say women are suddenly writing about sexuality with more freedom in the 90s, they are, and maybe in some ways my books have given permission to women to do that. But there's still a very clear archetype that has to be met in order for women to write about sex. A woman who is sexual and triumphs and doesn't stick her head in the oven is still a rarity.
Well, back to Henry Miller. It's interesting because the book has many different elements. There's a critical analysis, so to speak, of Miller. There's a biography. There's an exchange of letters. I think you have a fantasy dialogue. Miller, when he wrote Tropic of Cancer, which I think most people would concede would be his masterpiece, that was his third book. Is that correct?
The first one was Crazy Cock. The second one was Moloch, or vice versa. I don't remember because they were published. The first book he attempted was Clipped Wings, but he never finished that. So I guess you could say Tropic of Cancer was the third novel he wrote.
It's interesting
and
that,
finished.
That he was actually 39 or 40 when that book was published.
40. Mm-hmm.
He really got off. I was going to say to a late start, but he had been writing for quite a while.
He was a very late bloomer. He was considered a bum and a failure. His mother was embarrassed that he was such a ne'er-do-well. I think one of the reasons he left America and went to Paris was because in Paris he could be a ne'er-do-well and an artist, and in New York he was considered just a bum. His mother used to hide his typewriter in the closet because she was so embarrassed to have a son who was anything as shiftless as a writer. His parents were German-Americans. His father was a tailor. They were very bourgeois. They didn't approve of a son who wanted to be a writer. So he had that battle. And he was a very late bloomer. Very late.
Well, his relationship with his second wife, June, and what developed as a menage a trois was a catalyst for a lot of his work, wasn't it? Can you tell me about that?
I think he fell madly in love with June. June was a kind of alter ego. She was also, I guess, the kind of character we would now call a borderline personality. She didn't know the difference between dream and reality. And that kind of character, who has a great sense of her own drama, is always the kind of character writers fall in love with, because it's almost as if the character is calling to them, the character within the person is calling to them. They almost know that that kind of person is going to be someone they're going to write books about. Fitzgerald and Zelda is another example. A very self-dramatizing, very beautiful, and a woman who almost lives in a fantasy world. That was what June Mansfield Smith Miller was. And Henry fell madly in love with her. And he left his then wife, who was the mother of his first child, Beatrice. And he went to live with her. They had a speakeasy in Greenwich Village. They lived the bohemian life of the 20s. And June believed in him as a writer. She was the first one who did. They also had a passionate sexual relationship. She supported him so that he could write and eventually gathered enough money together so that they could take a trip to Paris and he could remain there while she went back to New York to make a living on her gold digging, she called it. Men who believed in her and loved her and whom she got money from. Whether she slept with them or not is not clear. And June became sort of the focus of Henry's writing life for nearly his entire creative life. She was the muse. She was this crazy, passionate character who drew him, you know, drew the writer out of him in a way. And she was extremely significant in his life. Though I think the great love of his life was Anaïs Nin, but he made a promise to Anaïs Nin never to use her as a character in fiction, and he kept that promise. So he kept going back to the relationship with June in book after book after book. I think in a way it's sad that he didn't write about Nin, because Nin was a great character in her own way. Anaïs wrote about Henry, but Henry didn't write about Anaïs.
You met Henry under kind of unusual circumstances, and it began with kind of a pen pal relationship.
Well, he wrote me this crazy, effusive, very kind letter, the kind of letter that a young writer dreams of getting.
He was in his 80s at that time.
He was 83. I had just published Fear of Flying. I was undergoing this transformation of young poet who taught courses at the 92nd Street Y, into public menace. If the Erica Jongs of this world have this way, women everywhere will be jumping from bed to bed. And, you know, I was considered not just a writer who had broken upon the scene and who was read with great interest, but in a way a symbol of all that was wrong with uppity women. So it was a pretty incredible experience, I must say. And also I was getting mail, amazing mail, not the kind of mail John Updike gets, but mail from people who wanted my soiled underwear to sniff. You know, that kind of mail. So it was a pretty traumatic year. And in the midst of this very traumatic year, when I'm suddenly thrust into the public eye in a way that rarely happens to people, I get this lovely, warm, kind letter from Henry Miller. So I had not read all of his books, or even most of his books.
Well, you read the good parts.
I read the good parts, right. So I began reading him to make myself worthy and writing first drafts of letters and second drafts of letters. And while I'm writing these drafts, because he's a legend and I better write a good letter back to him, another half a dozen letters appear on my doorstep. And he's just inundating me with mail about everything. And so finally I write back to him.
Could he have been lonely at that stage in his life?
He was always a great, great letter writer. I mean, he believed, when he and Lawrence Durrell lived in the same house, they exchanged letters. Henry didn't think something existed unless he wrote it down. He was a born writer. He wrote sometimes 20, 25 letters a day to people all over the world. I mean, I was only the latest recipient of his letter-writing mania. He was an utter scribomaniac. This guy wrote, and I think letters were the main literary product of his life. So he began writing to me, and eventually I went to California and met him.
And what was he like? Tell me about your first meeting with him.
He gave off heat like a blazing fire. He was the most alive person you had ever met. He was an old man. He was blind in one eye. He was carrying an aluminum walker. He was in and out of a wheelchair. He would come out to have dinner with you, and for 3 hours he would talk about his life and his loves, and then he would exhaust himself and be wheeled back into the bedroom. And if you waited around for a couple of hours, he'd sleep for a while, sort of fitfully, and then he'd get up and come back out and play a game of ping pong with one of the young people who was in his house and do some watercolors and then go back to bed. He had bursts of energy, but when he was awake, he was the most alive person you ever met. He looked like an old man, hunched over his walker, and yet when he started to talk, there was this animation. It was as if he had more life force than 10 people. He was extraordinary.
He was certainly lucid in reading the letters.
Oh, he was totally lucid. At the very, very, very end, he was not so lucid. I mean, Bill Pickerel, the artist whom I interviewed for The Devil at Large, told me that Henry, towards the very, very end of his life, when he was 88, the end, was sort of in and out of a dream state, not always knowing where he was. But when I knew him, he was totally lucid.
Now, your own letters to him, some of them were very explicit, dealing with adultery and masturbation. How does this make you feel at this point to willingly put them in this book and reveal yourself in this way?
Well, it was very hard to write this book. I mean, I think The Devil at Large was very hard because I had to break through to writing memoir. I mean, it's a memoir which is as much about myself as it is about Henry Miller. It's a book about two writers, and very much I see it as a book about writing and writers, a rather unconventional book, but I think it's the kind of book that could inspire writers. I had never written memoir before, and it was very hard to find the voice for the book. But now I see the value of writing in the first person, of trying to write honestly in the first person. And I'm going to do more books like it, because I think it's an interesting form. It's much easier, of course, to have the mask of, especially a mask that distances you, like Fanny Hackabout Jones, where you go back to another century. That's easier in a way. But I think that we do live in an age of memoir and biography. My friend Jay Perini says autobiography is the American form. He says it's the most particular American form. And he's looking at Thoreau, Walden. He's looking at Emma Goldman's memoirs. He says that our indigenous American form is autobiography. And perhaps that's true. He's a professor. I'm not. So.
Well, now, you touch upon some things that are very important and extremely perceptive dealing with censorship. I was talking last year to Edward DeGrazia, who wrote The Girls Lean Back Everywhere, which will be out next month, maybe this month, in paperback.
And a wonderful book.
It is a wonderful book.
Yeah,
and
wonderful.
Of course,
book.
A lot of that does have to do with Henry Miller and Barney Rossett, whom I also interviewed. I mean, Barney Rossett is another hero of mine. Sorry he lost Grove Press. But I began thinking about censorship and why it happens and what is censored. And the more I thought, the more it became apparent to me that what is censored is always sex. And I heard a broadcast on the radio this morning, just in passing, and the authorities somewhere were going to crack down on a club that had live sex acts on stage. And I began thinking, I didn't hear all the details, it was on in the kitchen, and I began to think, so what? I mean, who cares if somebody commits a sex act on a stage in a place that people willingly go to see?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what difference does it make? There's this uproar over homosexuality. Who cares if someone gets off, whether it's a heterosexual act or a homosexual? Who cares? It's not as though it's happening in a schoolyard. And all of the material that is censored relative to writing and movies. And I began to think, what is this seeming hate or fear of sexuality in this country? It would seem to me that if you really have to censor something, there are a lot of bloody things that could be censored. I mean, horrible death and disease. I mean, things that you don't really want to see at all. But sex? Now, you deal with this quite a bit. Is this our Victorian heritage?
I think that in America we are really still very puritanical. We still treat sex as if it's apart from life instead of a part of life. And we have such a curious attitude towards sex. It doesn't bother us to allow our children, even at a very young age, to sit in front of the TV and watch cop shows in which people are knocked over and are bleeding and disemboweled and God knows what. We let them watch anything, and it doesn't bother us. But we become so hypocritical and puritanical about sex. I think America really has a problem about sex. I think that we don't have the amused wink that the French have or the Italians have, that pertains in the Mediterranean world towards sex, where people say, everybody does it. You know, what? How are you going to prevent it? Our attitude about the body, about bodily functions, goes back to Puritanism, and even feminists partake of it. Many feminists are very anti-sex. I think it's one of the heritages of Puritanism, basically. And our country has a weird attitude about it, which is not yet gone. It's a totally hypocritical attitude, by the way, because if you read the new sex studies, what they show is that the people who do the most kinky sex are the evangelical right wing. You know, they are the ones who are doing the most S&M, the most weird stuff, you know, rubber suits and enemas and God knows what, and yet they want to prohibit it for everyone else. So this is a deep-rooted obsession in America.
Yeah, I can understand some animosity toward bad taste. People, for example,
censor the Home Shopping Channel.
Precisely.
If you don't want, I mean, there's bad taste.
The
Psychic Friends Network. Let's censor that.
Or the Family Channel, as far as that goes. But, you know, here are people saying, oh, we don't want an adult video store in our neighborhood. Now, I can understand that if they put a lot of tacky signs out front with nude women and this sort of thing, that may not be in the greatest taste. But that's only bad taste, really, when you think about it. I'm not sure that a video sex store hurts anybody at all. It might bring down property value, right? Don't you agree? But how does it hurt anybody?
Listen, how
does purchasing an X-rated tape and watching it at home hurt anybody?
It doesn't hurt anybody at all. And I think
But they would arrest you, I mean, if you have the wrong tapes or you... Having entertainments like that in places, you are subject to arrest, or have been in the past.
In the past, that's true. And also there's a whole faction, I think a very vocal but small minority of feminists who follow Andrea Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon, and who really think that the First Amendment is a sentimentality.
Well, aren't these the people who say that intercourse is a form of rape?
All intercourse is rape.
Yeah, all intercourse is rape.
And all men except impotent men are rapists.
Well, but that doesn't make sense.
Well, it's I think it's a minority of the feminist movement. It is not the majority. But they are heard because they have a very incendiary position. And that's their form of feminism. Honestly, I am a fierce feminist, and I believe that women are mistreated terribly in our society and denied power. But
Dworkin,
I don't think that's the way to redress the grievance.
I read a novel Dworkin wrote. I can't remember the name of it.
Mercy.
I can't remember mm-hmm. now. And that's very sexual.
Right, her own books would be censored.
It's a lesbian book, but it's extremely sexual, that the kind of book that might well have been censored a number of years ago.
She doesn't see the inconsistency in her position. Actually, she and I were on a panel together at the New School last week, and we have agreed to disagree. We have a good relationship. We talk to each other. We don't agree on this position at all, but we were able to really give a wonderful dialogue with each other on women and on the different positions of women. Dworkin is a brilliant woman. Really a brilliant woman and a passionate speaker. But I don't think she sees the connection between her own freedom to say what she needs to say and the First Amendment. She doesn't understand that the First Amendment is the underpinning of all that freedom.
Well, to wrap things up, Erica John, if Henry Miller were with us today looking out at the world and what's going on in terms of our literature and entertainment and so forth, do you suppose he would give us any kind of advice, and what might it be?
I think he would still say we had the air-conditioned nightmare. He would probably still say that a corn-fed hog has a better life in America than a poet or a writer. I think he would see a world that is devoted to greed and making money and despoiling the environment, which he wrote about in the air-conditioned nightmare, and he sounded a whole lot like Al Gore in that book, campaigning last November. I think he would say that we need to be reborn in order to make the world into an earthly paradise, that the change has to start inside the heart, that what we need is a spiritual rebirth. That was something he cared tremendously about. He would see the kind of sexuality that's readily available, and he wouldn't love it because he was no fan of pornography. He would see that self-liberation had still not been achieved by most people, and his whole subject always was self-liberation, and he saw sex as one means to self-liberation, but certainly not the only means. He was a man who corresponded with Thomas Merton and Isaac Bashevis Singer, and who was far more interested in the things that Merton was interested in than he was interested in the pornography sex shop. And I think he would still think that America was very far from Thoreau's vision or Whitman's vision. And those were his gurus and his mentors. So I think he would still be lashing us to bring us to our senses.
And in his work, of course, he's still speaking to us. He certainly was a trailblazer. Erica John, thank you very much. Very candid look at Henry Miller.
Thank you, Don.